Good evening and welcome to the Week in Review. I'm Paris Schutz. We'll be joined by our Week in Review guests in just a moment. But first, some of today's top stories. A Chicago police sergeant and officer have been charged with three felonies each in connection with a July shooting of an unarmed man. Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox announced charges of aggravated battery with a firearm, aggravated discharge of a firearm, and official misconduct today against Sergeant Christopher Leocopoulos and Officer Ruben Reynosa. The shooting happened July 22nd when the officers stopped to investigate a group of people walking near closed businesses near 18th and Morgan Streets. Fox says the officers made statements to legal authorities that contradicted video surveillance evidence.
The officers involved in this incident did not have provocation or justification to shoot the unarmed victim during this incident. The evidence does not support the use of deadly force related to the shooting of the unarmed victim and was not lawful.
And Chicago police announced that two men have been arrested and charged with five counts of first-degree attempted murder tied to a September 13th shooting of a 12-year-old boy. Isaiah Renteria and Pedro Molina are suspected in the weekend shooting on Chicago's Near West Side, in which they allegedly opened fire on the boy, his friends, and uncles as the group walked home from a store in the 1800 block of West 21st Place.
When they were walking back to the party, there were two gunmen in an alley that began shooting their weapons in the direction, striking this 12-year-old victim in the head. The victim is still in extremely critical condition.
Vice President Kamala Harris arrived in Chicago this afternoon. She was greeted on the tarmac at Midway by Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot and Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle, among other local dignitaries. The vice president is in town to participate in a roundtable about abortion rights at UIC. And this, of course, comes as Texas Governor Greg Abbott sent a bus of migrants to Washington, D.C. and dropped them off outside the vice president's official mansion. We're going to get into some of that in just a moment because it is time for our Week in Review panel. Joining us are Cheryl Ray Stoud, who covers Chicago sports for WBEZ, Dan Mihalopoulos, investigative reporter on WBEZ's government and politics team, Lorraine Forte, editorial page editor at the Chicago Sun-Times, and Rick Pearson, chief political reporter at the Chicago Tribune. So let's get right into it. Burr Ridge Mayor Gary Grasso had a bone to pick with Governor Pritzker over failing to notify him of migrants being sent to a hotel in that community. However, he had much kinder words for Mayor Lightfoot.
She apologized after a little bit. She's pretty feisty, you know, and she got a little feisty on the phone with us, but it turned out to be a very professional conversation. After that, she admitted that I had every right, my residents had every right to know what was going on ahead of time so we could prepare for all the normal questions to be answered. She then called me on Tuesday and followed up and wanted to know if there's anything more she could do. So I give her, a little belatedly, but I give her credit, not so much the governor.
And Dan Mihalopoulos, the governor, sent a letter apologizing to Mayor Grasso today for not giving him advance notice, for sending upwards of about 60 migrants to a hotel in Burr Ridge. Why are they there in the first place? Remind us.
So they've been bused from the border. Some of them have come from as far away as Venezuela. They walked through Central America, through Mexico, through some hazardous swamps and jungles, and then they find their way to the U.S. where they apply for asylum, which is legal. It's not illegal immigration or undocumented immigration. They're applying for asylum from a country that is in a very, very bad situation. And then all of a sudden, the governors in some of these states, Florida is involved as well, but Texas primarily, are sending them to sanctuary cities where they say that they do not enforce the immigration laws on a local level. Places like New York, Chicago, there was a plane load the other day to Martha's Vineyard. But I would remind people, whether we're talking about the city or the suburbs, this is Chicago. There have been waves of immigrants from all over the world and migrants from the south of our country who have come to Chicago and to the suburbs for generation after generation. My name is not Smith or Jones or Bobian or DuSable. I'm not descended from the founding fathers myself. I'm a second generation American. And I think a lot of people here are really nonplussed by what I think these governors thought. I'm really not sure what they thought would happen here, how we would react, because I think from all accounts, including from the migrants themselves, and some of them are in the northwest suburbs, were telling reporters that they've been treated very well, and they never imagined they would get this kind of support.
Cheryl Ray Stout, Dan mentioned, you know, there was that plane flown from Texas to Martha's Vineyard, although Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida said he was the one that orchestrated that because somehow they were going to end up in Florida or something like that. I'm not sure. Is this just flexing for conservative media here, for the base, to say, look, we're being tough on immigration?
This is a hot button issue for them to promote for the election because they know that the Roe v. Wade is actually the issue on the other side. So this is something they want to put front and center, put it right out there to their base. This is meat for their base. And that's what they want to do. And they want to cause some chaos with these other cities and these states that are dealing with this. The one thing is that every government that has these illegal immigrants coming here needs to be transparent about everything so we all know what's going on. And if you do it correctly, it should smooth the waters with the public.
Rick Pearson, how are Governor Pritzker and Mayor Lightfoot handling the migrants that have been bused up to Chicago, some of them, as we mentioned, out to the suburbs in Burr Ridge?
Well, it seems to be actually pretty seamless, despite the fact of the complaints that these are people, these asylum seekers, are showing up in buses at Union Station, sometimes in the middle of the night. There's no advance warning that's being provided by Governor Abbott in Texas or his authorities. There's no real contact to try to convey to these places that are the destination areas, be it New York or wherever. They have no idea when these buses are arriving. And so it's been an active effort by the state to kind of use its emergency resource abilities for temporary housing. The governor has filed an emergency disaster declaration to try to help mobilize some of the logistics and ease those logistics. He's also called up 75 National Guardsmen for logistics purposes. I mean, Mayor Grasso, you know, it certainly a courtesy would have been to, you know, say we're going to be doing this. But the fact of the matter is, the hotel was reserved by the state, had been reserved by the state for emergency services. There's really nothing that Mayor Grasso needs to do except try to be welcoming to these people.
Pritzker mentioned the state has a contract with that hotel. They housed Afghan refugees when some of them arrived here. Lorraine Ferte, there are midterms right around the corner and everything is political right now. Who does this help more? Republicans trying to look tough and strong or Democrats trying to look empathetic and compassionate?
Well, I think if you look at the reception these people have received, if you want to look at it in horse race terms, it benefits the Democrats. The Democrats didn't panic. They didn't treat them badly. You know, there's been no, you know, rejection of these people. We've been welcoming of them. Illinois has been welcoming of them. Martha's Vineyard has been welcoming of them. So I suppose it depends if you're in Texas or Florida and you want to see, you know, Ron DeSantis and Greg Abbott look like they're doing something, flexing, if you want to call it, then, you know, maybe it helps them. But then if they look at the reception, if they think that it's something that's going to destabilize Chicago or make us look bad or, you know, make Illinois look bad or make New York or other places look bad, it hasn't, because these asylum seekers have been welcomed for the most part.
And I should mention that we have seen media outlets in some quarters misrepresent the fact, because as Dan mentioned, as we understand, these are mostly or all asylum seekers, so they're not illegal immigrants, quote unquote.
No,
they have a legal status while their cases get adjudicated here. I want to move over to another big issue in the governor's race, the Safety Act, or the pretrial release part of the Safety Act. That's blown up in campaign mailers and memes online, a lot of misinformation out there. Dan Mihalopoulos, are Democrats having to play a little bit of defense on this massive bill?
Right. They're having to counter disinformation and misinformation on a grand scale. You know, it was the Safety Act last week. This week, it's J.B. Pritzker's trans cousin. This is
who is a big Republican donor, by the way, we should mention.
Yeah. And you know, these are issues that are hot button issues that they're trying to leverage in the midterm elections in the state, in the federal level. And I get that. But, you know, they're fake newspapers. They're not newspapers that are there. And they would counter that, you know, I think Dan Prof's line was the, you know, the NPR Sun Times, because, you know, now our station and the Sun Times are both under Chicago Public Media, or he would argue that the two newspapers are too far to the left. But, you know, this week I did a story about one of the top Democrats in Springfield. You're not going to see a story about any Republicans, a negative story in the North Cook News or any of these propaganda sheets or political mailers that are masquerading as journalism. And they have every right to do that as long as they don't libel or defame anyone. I'm not sure that I can clear them of those charges, but I can say that there's a lot of misinformation in there, particularly around this legislation that will go into effect at the beginning of next year.
You mentioned Dan Proft, that newspaper you held up. Those are campaign mailers disguised as newspapers. Dan Proft operating a PAC called People Who Play By The Rules. That is funded by Richard Uihlein, who is a big Republican donor in this state. And we'll talk about an ad that they put up that was taken down by many TV stations in a minute. But Rick Pearson, you know, back to the Safety Act, I interviewed a bunch of stakeholders this week. And my takeaway here is there is some confusion about many provisions in this law and what it does, specifically what crimes exactly a judge can hold someone in prison for. Because, again, this gets rid of cash bail for all but the most serious of felonies. So is this going to be a problem when this goes into effect in January?
Well, your basic question to Dan was, are Democrats playing defense? And yes, they are. I mean, this is a very, very complicated piece of legislation, and it makes it easy for disinformation, not just Dan Prof's fake newspapers, but disinformation from state's attorneys, different disinformation from sheriffs, disinformation from Republican candidates for office who are trying to paint Democrats soft on crime. And it's easy disinformation to disseminate because it is very complex. But there are some fundamental natures here, and a lot of the disinformation comes down to this idea that on January 1, when this law goes into effect, that the jail doors are going to spring open and all of these people are automatically charged with heinous crimes or are going to be flooding into your neighborhood. Not true. Not true. I think why you're seeing a lot of state's attorneys, about roughly, I guess, 100 of the 102 state's attorneys are opposed to this, is because I think it's going to have to make them work harder. Because everybody who is available for release has to face an individual hearing before a judge. Say somebody gets a hearing, it's not challenged by the state's attorney, that person goes out later and commits a very heinous crime. Who's going to wear the jacket for that? It's the state's attorney. They are elected. Judges aren't. I think that's really where part of this whole disinformation and opposition campaign is coming from.
Right,
that
right.
Being said, Democrats are, I've been talking about tightening up some of the language here to make it clear about what police duties are available. But, it, you know, these lines that people can trespass in your front lawn and the police can't do anything but issue a citation. No, they can arrest somebody. They can detain them. They can move them off your property. They still retain their arrest powers.
Right. So getting rid of cash bail here, you're right. The law says that within 48 hours, if someone is going to be detained pre-trial and not released, that they're going to have a hearing here. So it does add another layer. Lorraine Forte, should Democrats, all this being said, should they, after the midterms perhaps, go back and tweak parts of this law that are causing confusion?
Well, I think one of the main thing that needs to happen, first of all, is for people, and as Rick said, this is a very complex bill. It's, you know, hundreds of pages long, I believe. Explain some of the provisions, explain how this misinformation is misinformation. And if there are things that need to be tweaked regarding when people who are what the criteria are for judging when someone is a safety risk, what are those criteria? If that needs to happen, then that needs to happen. I mean, people are concerned about crime, but you cannot let them be swayed by misinformation. But at the same time, if there are things in a bill that need to be tightened up, then you just have to tighten them up.
And- And Governor Pritzker and other Democrats have tried to counter some of that. And of course, the Republicans mm-hmm. say, well, that's misinformation, which makes a journalist's job all the more important here to really get into that 700 pages and all of those provisions and try to determine where the truth is here. But still, maybe some of those provisions will be tweaked in the coming months. I want to move to this controversial ad by the PAC that we mentioned. It was taken down, but it showed a white woman in Lakeview who was attacked by what appears to be black men. Cheryl Ray Stout, did this ad cross a line in terms of sort of a kind of a racial provocation?
In many ways it did. I mean, when I first saw it, it went through my body. It just shocked me. You know, I saw it on Twitter, you know, the original thing, but the way this was presented, the way this, the sounds, it just gets to your core. And I think it's just, and the victim, you know, should have been notified that they were going to do this. They didn't do that with her.
Right.
She needed to know this happened, because can you imagine she's sitting there watching television and she has to relive this incident that really hurt her life? I mean, that was unconscionable.
And in fact, a lawyer for the victim said that she would not have approved this trauma being used, but many TV stations have taken this down. Dan Mihalopoulos, is this ad from Dan Proft and Dick Uihlein, is this kind of in line with like the Willie Horton ad from the 80s or former President Richard Nixon's Southern strategy, really a strategy of scaring white people based on race?
Yeah, I think those are good analogies. We're looking at a situation here where what they're trying to do is take the crime data from the city and really scare people in swing areas outside the city or in wealthier parts of the city, that crime, you know, is rising there also. And that, you know, I would also point out one of the reasons why this ad was taken down was not just the reasons that you've brought up already, but also because it was altered. And again, this is something that you won't see journalists doing, and again, this was a campaign ad, but nevertheless, there were changes made in the sound and in different parts of that video for that ad to make it more of a fear-mongering tactic. And again, I think that's absolutely unethical.
Well, and when you talk about, you know, as a Barb and said here, this is Dan Proft, okay? We've seen this before from him. We've seen the fake newspapers from him. We saw the great famed Jeannie Ives ad that mocked gays, that mocked Jeannie Ives teachers, trans. It mocked women seeking abortion. There is no bottom here, and he doesn't care. And quite frankly, I think what he cares about most is just getting the attention.
And certainly that did get attention, if that was the goal, and certainly a visceral reaction on both sides.
I don't even think it's about electoral politics. I think it's about getting attention.
Get personal attention, you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. That's interesting. Well, let's switch over to GOP candidate Darren Bailey, who that ad is tangentially in support of, although they're not affiliated with the campaign. Darren Bailey has taken up temporary residence in the building formerly known as the John Hancock to, quote, immerse himself in the culture of Chicago. And he again called out Governor Pritzker on crime on Wednesday.
Someone who loves Illinois wouldn't try to paint a rosy picture while more than 500 people have been murdered in Chicago, mainly in these black and minority communities. Where are you at? JB, your administration is absolutely incompetent. Our greatest city is a crime-ridden hellhole, and you don't care.
And there's that word again, or two words that he's quadrupled and quintupled down. Rick Pearson, what is living in the Hancock building all about?
Well, you know, you almost think about going back to the days of Jane Byrne moving into Cabrini Green. And you know, rather than going into a housing project, he's going to North Michigan Avenue. I don't know what kind of culture he's expecting to be immersed in. Except the Cheesecake Factory. I really don't know. And in fact, when he went to Washington Park for that press conference where those remarks were, after his remarks, he was greeted by various residents of the community, including some violence interruption groups, who basically said, don't use us as your political prop. You're coming here for the first time, and you know, what are your answers? And of course, his answers to a lot, like they have been to a lot of things, are, Well, we're all going to sit around a table and we're all going to talk about it. That's his answer pretty much for everything.
Well, he's talked about repealing the Safety Act, too.
Which is not going to happen.
Right, with majorities. Lorraine, yeah, and since you are an op-ed writer here, I should pose this question to you about that ad. I mean, was that ad over the line?
Well, of course. I mean, you know, anytime you have an ad with a screaming woman who happens to be white and two folks who, you know, are appear to be black, or whenever you darken someone's skin, as happened with Mayor Lightfoot, of course, it's not even a dog whistle. It's like a dog horn, you know, at that point. I mean, of course. I mean, there's just no doubt about it.
It's surprising some of the stations ran it in the first place. I remember seeing it during the Bears game. Speaking of the Bears. Go ahead.
And Mark. I don't know whether they knew it was altered or not, but that in itself is unkind. You know, that's completely unacceptable.
And speaking of the Bears, Sherrill Stout, they seem to shock all the national pundits that believe they're the worst team in football by a very convincing win over what's supposed to be a playoff team last weekend, San Francisco. What are their odds in Green Bay this week?
It's not going to be easy, but the fact is Aaron Rodgers and his team lost on Sunday, and so he usually does very well his second game back, but he doesn't have a lot of weapons that he had before, and also his offensive line is really hurting right now. There's a lot of injuries. So it's going to be really important for the Bears defense to try to pin him, to not allow him to scramble and not allow him to get the ball off too quickly. If they can do that and do what they did on Sunday, the Bears were very disciplined. They did not get many penalties. They only had 3 penalties in the whole game, which is as opposed to San Francisco, who had 12. And that was the tail of the tape. The other thing is Justin Fields, if he could play like he did in the second half of the game, despite all those odds with the rain going crazy and stuff like that, if he can play the way he did, he can have some success. It's going to be an interesting game because talking to Matt Eberflus, the head coach of the Bears, he doesn't put a lot of stock into the rivalry, but I've talked to
him. He hasn't been here long enough.
No, I've talked to players and they, like Cole Kmet, who was from the suburbs, he's really into it, you know what I mean? So some of the players are, and veterans like Robert Quinn, he's played 9 times against Aaron Rodgers, and he's never won. He wants to get to the quarterback this
Sunday. That's motivation there. But before the show, we were talking about the record under Brett Favre and Aaron Rodgers going back 30 years. Packers are 45 and 15 against the Bears. An unbelievable, unbelievable record. So it's time to turn that tide. And the White Sox have kind of turned the tide a little bit on their season as Tony La Russa has struggled with his health issues. They're 3 games behind Cleveland. They're playing them in a series this week. What is that matchup going to be like?
Well, first, this weekend's going to be important because they're playing the Tigers. If they can make some ground up, you know, and win the series against the Tigers. And then when you look at Cleveland's playing Minnesota for 5 games. So these next several games is going to be very important once the White Sox have to play the Cleveland. So it's going to be really, really tough. You know, you only have 18 games left. You know, it's going to be a hard, you know, hard to get into the postseason at this point, but you never know. Anything can happen. And the way this team has been playing without Tony La Russa, with Miguel Cabrera in the dugout, they played very well. They're scoring runs. They're starting pitching, you know, is in sync. But I just don't know if they can make up enough ground.
Yeah, 3 games to go with 18 left. They're going to have to win a lot. And is La Russa done for the year? And probably for his White Sox career?
He's not with the team still in Detroit, so that's an interesting note. I'm kind of curious how upper management and ownership, Jerry Reinsdorf, is going to handle this. The best thing for them to do is to sit down with Tony and say, look, this is your health. You had a health scare. You had to have your pacemaker replaced. Is that worth it? And also, on the other hand, is this team is winning without you. You have to look at that realistically and realize that you go into that dugout, it could be a distraction. It could unravel what they've been doing. A
very complicated situation that upper management and ownership has to deal with there. But we are out of time now. So our thanks to Cheryl Ray Stout, Dan Mihalopoulos, Lorraine Forte, and Rick Pearson. Thank you all so much. And before we go tonight, some thoughts on a Chicago icon who died this week. Ramsey Lewis was not only a giant of jazz, but a Chicago civic treasure. He grew up in Cabrini-Green and quickly developed a flair for playing the piano at the church where his father was gospel director. He was known for re-envisioning rock and pop hits like The In Crowd and Hang On Sloopy for jazz, but was a celebrated composer in his own right. His music was soulful, funky, slinky, and combined everything from blues to world to classical. He made sure that jazz, an art form sometimes reserved for the most esoteric of ears, was accessible for everyone. He furthered that education through his daily show on WNUA Radio and his TV program, Legends of Jazz, filmed right here at WTTW. And he was ubiquitous around Chicago, performing free concerts in places like Daly Plaza or Millennium Park. Our city is indeed richer because of his artistry and devotion. Lewis was 87 years old, and of course we have his beautiful music forever. And that's our show for this Friday night. And now for the Week in Review, I'm Paris Schutz. Thank you so much for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a great weekend.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that is proud of its partners named Illinois Leading Lawyers by the Law Bulletin Publishing Company of Chicago.